This is the Marketing Podcast Network. You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Welcome to Uncorking a Story, the podcast that introduces you to the rich world of storytellers who share their personal journeys, creative processes, and the stories behind their stories, one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Mike Carlin, and I'm thrilled to be part of your writing journey. If you're an aspiring writer, a literary enthusiast, or simply someone who believes in the transformative power of words, you've come to the right place. Every week, we'll pop the cork on the world of successful storytellers and give you a healthy pour of inspiration, insight, and empowerment. My mission is to help writers like you realize your full potential through the transformative and therapeutic power of writing. Whether you're just starting your literary voyage or looking to refine your craft, I'm here to provide you with the knowledge, inspiration, and encouragement you need to embark on your own storytelling adventure. So, are you ready to uncork your story and let your creativity flow? Uncorking a Story is about to begin. Sit back, relax, and let the transformative magic of storytelling whisk you away. Welcome to Uncorking a Story. Well, hey now, and welcome to another exciting episode of Uncorking a Story. I'm Mike Carlin, and I'm so happy to have you with me as I uncork yet another great story. I want to remind you to please follow Uncorking a Story on all social media platforms, including Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and TikTok. You can find us at Uncorking a Story on all of those platforms. If you only listen to Uncorking a Story as an audio podcast, I encourage you to please watch us on YouTube, as it's a great way to connect with me in the comments and interact with others in the Uncorking a Story community. There's a fair number of you out there now, which I'm so grateful for. So I encourage you to please subscribe to our YouTube channel by going to YouTube, searching for Uncorking a Story, and hitting that subscribe button. For you audio listeners out there, I haven't forgotten about you. Please rate, subscribe, and review Uncorking a Story wherever you get your podcast. Now, today on the show, we have a really interesting author named Boo Trundle, whose first published novel, The Daughtership, is now available wherever books are sold. Now, I say it's her first published novel because, like many authors, her first manuscripts were not sold, even though she had agent representation. And that's just a little reminder that having an agent is no guarantee that your manuscript will actually become a published novel. But that said, it really, really helps to have an agent. It really does. Now, Boo and I have this really interesting conversation about different parts of self. You'll hear about that probably about halfway through the episode. And it's a reminder that, you know, what the world sees on the outside for each and every one of us isn't totally reflective of who we really are. Others do not see our inner selves. You know, we all have different parts. We all have different parts living inside us. And I know this is going to sound very woo-woo, but we all have an inner child. We all have an inner teenager. And yes, we even have an inner adult self. And these different parts of self work below the surface of our consciousness to really protect us from what they might consider to be something that's harming. Now, these are the inner workings of ourselves that jumpstart our fight or flight reactions in certain situations. We actually talk about fight or flight in this episode as well. But you know, this is way too much to go into for an episode introduction. So I'm going to give a plug for my episode with Lori Jean Glass from an organization she founded called Pivot. And Lori Jean, by doing like a week long workshop with her, I really, you know, learned a lot about different parts of self. You know, we even gave these different parts of myself different names. And, you know, she really taught me how to respect and repair those inner parts of self so that I could become a healthier adult. And when Boo did this parts work herself, now she didn't necessarily do Pivot. We don't talk about how she did her parts work, but she did discussed doing, you know, work on parts of self, her creativity started to flow. It started to flourish. And that's actually what led to The Daughtership, which, of course, is her first published novel. And she's been writing since, you know, writing seriously since the late 1990s. So that's really interesting work to do. And my goal, I just want to remind you, with Uncorking a Story, is to help make you a better writer. So today's lesson is to take some time and get to know your various parts of self. And if you want a resource to help you there, check out Pivot at lovetopivot.com. Now, let's uncork Boo Trundle's story. Boo Trundle is a writer, artist, and performer whose work has appeared across various platforms and publications, including The Brooklyn Rail, McSweeney's Internal Tendency, and NPR's The Moth. She has released 3 albums of original music with Big Deal Records and joins me today on Uncorking a Story to talk about her first novel, The Daughtership. Welcome to Uncorking a Story, Boo.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you here, Boo, and I'm curious, where does your story as an author begin?
Well, I guess I was always imaginative and lost in fantasy from the reports I've gotten from various school tests and creative writing experiences. But I would say, really, I became a serious author like in high school. That's when I started getting feedback, 11th grade, 12th grade, that my writing was different or powerful or worth putting energy into from like a beloved English teacher.
I was going to say, did you have one of those like beloved teachers that kind of guided you and inspired you? Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about that person?
Well, her name was Bat Masterson. I think her real name was Patricia, but everyone called her Bat. And she passed away. She was probably in her 60s or 70s in the 80s, right? So she's been gone for a while, but she was just very kooky and open-minded and encouraging. And that was back in the days of liquid whiteout, you know, so I would write these papers and I would handwrite them. We didn't have computers. I sound like I'm 100 years old, but we didn't have computers. And so we didn't have to type them. We'd write them by hand. Then half my page would be covered with whiteout. And then I would write over it, crackled. Like I'd have liquid paper all over my hands when I got to school. But she just really encouraged me to go hog wild. And I did go hog wild. And so that was when I really discovered the pleasure of writing and also the pleasure of writing essays and reading and coming up with connections to books that I'd read that I felt had changed me. And that made me want to write books that would change people. So that was really the turning point for me as an author.
Yeah. Did you remember any of those books that you read in high school that kind of left their mark on you?
Well, the one I always talk about is The Brothers Karamazov by Fyodor Dostoevsky. And that was, you know, we had a very open reading list in the sense that in order to sort of qualify as an AP English student, you could read whatever books you want. You just had to read a lot of books. And she let us write papers about whichever books we wanted, as long as we proved that the book had value by writing a good paper about it. So I read The Brothers Karamazov. It was one of those books that I picked it up. I thought I would hate it. And then I stayed up like 3 nights in a row until 2 in the morning reading it. That's just the best feeling when you're reading something. You don't want to go to sleep. You never want to leave that world. And then after you finish the book, you just think about the characters all the time and wish you could go back. That was the experience I had with that book. So that's the one I mostly remember. But also Grapes of Wrath, classic books. We were reading classics.
Yeah, I remember.
Oh, I also loved Danielle Steele, though. Does not forget Danielle Steele.
Well, hey, look.
What'd you say? I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's okay. I mean, that could keep you up at night, too. I think a good Danielle Steele novel. So.
what were you going to say?
No, I remember, like, you mentioned the days of whiteout, and I, too, was in high school in the 80s. And yeah, we were fortunate to have a computer at home, which was really just a... It really wasn't much of a computer. It was like a glorified box. But I remember whiteout. I didn't necessarily have whiteout all over my paper. I remember like painting my pencils with whiteout and then like sniffing them. That was like one of my pastimes in high school.
I don't know. I think I used to chew on my pencils till they broke in my mouth. Maybe we were just really bored.
Yeah, well, I could have been. I you know, you said you kind of had this fantasy world you may have lived in as a child. I was definitely a little bit bored in some of my classes as a
as a kid. But that was probably more on me and not necessarily on the hardworking teachers of the school system I was in.
Yes, I'm not. There's no blame.
So after high school, what was next? Did you go off to college to study writing, or did you go off to study something else?
I did study writing in college. I went to Brown, and they had a really loose curriculum where you didn't have any requirements. You could take things pass fail. You could experiment. And I did. So I took almost all English and creative writing and philosophy and visual art in college. Sort of regret it now sometimes. I didn't do a little more math, a little more practical history. There's some fuzzy edges around my understanding of geography, but I did exactly what I want to do, which was read books, write about them, write creatively, and make art in college. And that's what I'm still doing now. So
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I find that, you know, sometimes history and geography come into play. Like if I'm really into a Jeopardy, you know, they come in handy. But not always in everyday conversation. So
well, I sort of find that I make a fool of myself more often in that area. So I just try to keep my mouth shut. You know, I'll just like, I think I'll get Belfast mixed up with Belgrade and, you know, doing things that are just better to just nod my head and act like I know what everyone's talking about.
There you go. There you go. Well, what can you
share? That's a skill. That's a life skill right there.
Well, that is a good, to be able to think on your feet is certainly a life skill. For sure.
Just keep your mouth shut.
Well, that's a very important life skill that many of us need to practice more often than perhaps that we do.
Well, not right now, not during a podcast, but.
Well, you know, it's an occupational hazard for me in situations such as these.
Yeah, you're doing a productive channeling.
That's right. That's right. What can you share with us about The Daughtership, which I believe is your first novel?
A lot, really. I could talk for hours about The Daughtership. It's not the first novel that I've written, but it's the first novel I've gotten published. And I think that the reason it was accepted by the publisher who accepted it is because it's very unique. It is, I've heard people say it's a one-off or like a one-of-a-kind book. And I would say that people describe it that way because of the way that it's put together. It's very structurally inventive. And part of the reason it's so inventive is because I don't think the way other people think. And I don't, like in terms of just my subjectivity, the way that I experience story or want to tell a story, I often find even if I'm talking to someone, I'll come at it from like five different ways in order just to get to the end. And that's sort of the way the book is written. And I finally just accepted that about myself. I was always trying to write novels the way everybody else did. And then I finally just said, you know, I'm just going to write this the way that it comes naturally to me. And I guess that was the winning move, because this is my first published novel and I'm 56, you know, I started sending my first novel around in 93. So it's been a while. I've been trying to get published.
Yeah.
So it's pretty exciting for me. It's been a really big year. Really. Yesterday, someone asked me like, how has that affected your mental health? I said, that's a good question, but I think I dodged it, but it was a good question because it's been a really intense, pretty exciting, but also sort of a wild. It's sort of wild when your dream comes true.
Yeah. Well, I do want to get into a little bit of the content of the book and what it's about. But before we do, since you did mention, you know, writing since 93 and you know, querying and pitching since then, what did you learn about yourself through the I hate to say the word rejection, but that is the reality that we all live with. What did you learn about yourself, you know, by being rejected from those, you know, earlier works?
Well, I've learned a lot about myself just through the process of being an artist. I was just reading a book about, I love reading books about other artists, especially artists that I admire, because a lot of them struggled to get an audience or to get success. And I was reading about William Blake, who just was sort of hapless and hopeless during his lifetime. And now is, you know, one of the most famous artists of his generation, which was like in like 1700s in London. But it was just about how like all these other hacks were getting so much more success than he was at the time. But it's not like we want to hang our life dreams on hopefully being famous after we're dead. That's not the way I want to live my life. I just mean it as it's part of the experience of being a creative person, being committed to your vision, and learning how to make art, which I include writing as art, you have to be prepared for failure and rejection, but not just rejection, failure, just failure in the eyes of people that you know, that for so many years, I would say I'm a writer, but I didn't really feel like anyone believed me or that I had any clout because I didn't have a book. I didn't have a published book. And so now I have a published book and I realize it's not really different on one side of that than the other in terms of your daily life. It's just, and I guess I wish I had known that. I did really figure that out at some point. Like, a writer writes. If you write, you're a writer. You do not have to have a published book to call yourself a writer, but you do need to write. That's difficult. Even showing up for the page all the time is difficult, but also just believe, like for me, also just continuing to do it without any outside support or validation. You know, I just, when you're getting rejected, I mean, there's different levels of rejection. There's sending a manuscript out. There's trying to find an agent. There's sending short stories out. There's trying to get residencies. There's so many different areas where you can be rejected, but to just continue to get up the next morning and believe in your project and have that be your North Star just is probably, it's character building. And it's probably, if you can hang in there, it's going to make your art and your writing that much better. I really do believe that. That may sound very like glass half full, but I really do believe that it's okay to be out in the cold for a long time, because when you're out in the cold, you're honing your skills and you're getting to be more original, more yourself. You're not trying to prove anything for anyone and no one's watching you, and you're kind of left to be free to become the artist that you could really be without. So yeah, I guess that's a pitch for failure, a pitch for continued rejection. What a wonderful thing.
I know that could be a title of an episode, the pitch for continued rejection. I think it's got a ring to it. But I do think as people, and not just, you know, as writers, but in general in life, we do learn a lot more through our failures, through our disappointments, through our setbacks, than sometimes we do from our success. Because you know, if we still have that drive to push forward, you know, it does force us to kind of question, okay, what is it that we've been doing that's not working? And what is it that we could be doing that may work? It seems like maybe you, and tell me if I misheard you, but you know, you changed your approach to writing. So you were writing in a way that was more, you know, suitable for you than for necessarily other people. And what worked for other people, you know, wasn't necessarily working for you. Did I hear that correctly with this one?
Yeah, you did hear that. That is correct. And it was sort of full circle, because my first instinct when I wrote a novel at the end of college, like the end of my senior year, sort of started as my thesis, and then I finished it in my early 20s. And that book was written from multiple points of view. There were all kinds of characters that needed to be heard that were just speaking up, and it was a bit of a mess, and it didn't get picked up. And even I, when I looked back at it years later, couldn't really understand it, but my instinct was there to just come at the story from lots of different points of view, and also the different points of view not always agreeing on what the story was. And then I really settled in and tried to write something more traditional, just beginning, middle, end, traditional story from one character's point of view, even if it was third person or first person, but just taking one person's story, one person's eyes, one person's thoughts, and also the agreed upon reality, which, you know, realistic fiction, agreed upon by all of us. And then my new novel, it's very fantastical, very speculative. There's things that are going in the novel that could never happen in the real world. So I guess, yeah. So the two things that changed that I came back full circle to are a completely imaginary realm, that's not at all based in reality, coupled with realistic fiction to keep the reader engaged. I can't write, has to be somewhat realistic or readers aren't going to have anywhere to anchor themselves. So it's that, and then it's the multiple voices, and somehow it worked this time. So it just took me 30 years to circle back around the paddock and like do it better and do it right, and also find an editor that appreciated it.
How did you do that?
Well, I have a really great agent, and her name's Alice Tasman Morris, and she's been my agent since the second novel, like 25 years ago. So she has gone out, she's been watching me progress and also helping me. We tried to get my other novels published. So she just really knows me, really believes in me, and she knew who to send it to. And she's a literary, she represents literary fiction, which is not that common anymore. And like, it is truly a literary novel. It's not a genre novel. It's not like a it's not like a well-written mystery book. It's truly literary in the sense that it's about, it's kind of a novel about itself. It's, the novel teaches you to read it as you read it. And it's, yeah, it's literary. So she knew who to send it to, and she sent it to an editor who, her name's Deb Garrison, and I adore her. And she buys poetry and fiction. So she's a poet and a fiction editor. And she is actually a poet. She edits fiction and she buys poetry. She buys fiction. So she was the perfect person for this novel because it is a very poetic novel, even though it's fiction. So she was just perfect. You know, she was just, it was just a perfect match. And you really have to find that, I think. It's not easy. So there, and everybody used to always say that to me, but I didn't really believe them until it happened. And then now I see that there's not, it's just a matter of the manuscript finding its way to the right desk.
Yeah. I love this notion of you having this agent for 25 plus years. And this is sort of the first thing that she sold, and just her sticking with you throughout that time. I mean, it's certainly a testament to you and what you've shown her over those years. And it seems
that,
like,
kind of makes me want to cry even thinking about it. It was quite the celebration that night when we sold the novel. It was quite the celebration. Her husband even came.
I'm sure. No doubt. It's really a beautiful story. And it's not something that I hear very often. You know, I hear these fantastical stories sometimes where, you know, a first time author, you know, sells a book to a publisher and then has to, you know, quickly find an agent to represent her, to structure the contract. And, you know, that's sort of the exception to the rule, obviously. But, you know, I hear more stories like that than a story. And then I hear the other story, right? So I had this agent, they couldn't sell my first manuscript, they couldn't sell my second, and we had to part ways. But this is a completely different story than those two. I think it's fantastic and certainly motivating for aspiring authors out there that's possible.
It is. It's wonderful. And it doesn't mean that there were, like, you know, there were long periods where I wasn't really in touch with her, because if I didn't have anything for her, there was no point in, you know, pestering her. And, you know, because that's the other thing about being a writer. You have to provide the content for your agent to do something with. So it's like, say it's a real estate agent. If your house is not, like, you know, you have to do something to help sell the house too. The house has to be cleaned up and, like, look presentable, and you have to own the house in order to sell it. So it's, with an agent, it is really a two-way street. It's that, you know, I had to keep going too. Like, she had to believe in me. And then when we got, you know, she would send, like, the first novel was called Teresa Breathe, and the second was called When the Children Were Babies. And that one went out probably in like 2008, and she sent it to a lot of people. No, people didn't really understand that one. I think there was a spiritual element to it. There was a Christian character in the book, and the feedback we were getting was, you should send this to a Christian publisher. And it was one of those things where it didn't matter. It wasn't a book for Christians. It just, she was like an evangelical Christian character, but it really threw people off. And maybe it was just the timing of it. It was 2009. Maybe now it wouldn't bother people, but people don't want anything to do with it. And so, you know, when those things happen, I just had to go back to the drawing board and just say, thank you so much, Alice. We did our best. And now I'm going to go write another novel. It is not easy to go back to your computer at that point. It's not easy, but you have to want to. I mean, it has to be something you love doing, I guess, or you're crazy. I mean, I think I'm a little, I always also joke, I thought about this earlier. I think I'm a genius, obviously, because only someone who believes they're a genius would continue in the, with all of that, you know, 30 years.
Well, you know, it may be hard to go back to your computer at that point, but it would probably be harder to go back to your, you know, loose leaf paper and whiteout and pencil. You
know? Well, honestly, I still do a lot of writing by hand, but it ends up on the computer eventually.
All right. I'm sure. Well, what can you tell us about the theme and the overall story of the daughtership without, of course, giving too much away?
The theme of the book is integration, I would say. The main character is very split off from herself, and she's getting along in her life. She's surviving, but she's not thriving. And so she's not a person that doesn't have self-knowledge, and she's not a person that hasn't done healing work or tried to make something of her life, but it's just not working. So she's in her 40s. So I think what's interesting about my main character, her name's Catherine, she's not hapless. She's not ignorant of herself. She's not someone who's just like blundering along through life. She's quite in touch with herself, and she has really tried, but she's failed. So it's really kind of like, I always talk to people about this, like, you know, what if you, like, say you're an alcoholic and you go to AA and it doesn't work, you know, like, or say you're like a cigarette smoker and you keep trying to quit and you can't, you know, so it's really someone who has really tried. We were talking about failure. She's tried to make her life work, and it's just not working. And the reason it's not working is because she's very split off from parts of herself that she has left behind, hoping they would disappear, but they're kind of still haunting her. And so these parts of her actually are represented by these little girls that live on a submarine. And that's, there's a submarine on the cover of the book, and it's called the Daughtership, and the ship is the submarine. And so these three little girls are stuck at the bottom of the ocean in a submarine, and they're running out of air. And so the two plots are kind of chugging along next to each other. Catherine in her 40s, whose life is falling apart, her marriage is falling apart, she's having a hard time parenting. And these three little girls who are trying to get out of this situation where they're trapped in a defunct submarine. And so these plots start to interweave. And that's really how the book works.
I have to ask, are the three girls the same age, or are they different ages?
Well, yeah, there's two girls and a boy, in that sense that we all have many like genders, I think, inside of us. So it's Smushed Bug is 8. Truett is 15. He's a boy, and he's a bully, very much in charge, like a little Boy Scout type, always trying to fix the engine, but is not really mature enough to know how. And then Star is a 13-year-old girl, but she's 13 going on 30, and really represents Catherine's sexuality, I would say.
Maybe someone forced to grow up a little too fast, or?
Yeah. Forced to grow up a little too fast. And also, I don't know, like that's one of the themes of the books too, is just how kids take in so much. We don't really give them credit for knowing what they know, but I don't know. I know that when I was little, I used to listen to love songs when I was 4, and I kind of knew what they were about, even though I didn't. You kind of pick it up from the atmosphere. And then I also think that we all just have this kind of knowingness that we almost grow into. I think we don't give kids enough credit for what they really understand and know and can sort of experience like psychically, even though they're in these little squatty bodies.
Yeah. But in some way, I believe that we actually, you know, come into this life knowing a lot more than we're actually taught along the way.
Right.
And I love this notion of these three parts of self, which I think is what you're saying, that these, you know, three children represent, or maybe different parts of self. I'm a big psychology nerd, and I've also done a lot of self work. And I did this one kind of week long intensive out in California, where parts of self were like, it was like a center point of the whole week, and just understanding your various parts of self, which are often represented by, you know, an inner child and an inner teenager, you know, your younger selves, and the role that those younger selves still play in your adult life. You know, which ones are the protectors, you know, it kind of understanding, they really integrate into your adult relationships, and understanding them and paying attention to them is actually critical in having healthy adult relationships. And so this makes me really curious about the daughter. I'm very excited about it.
Well, yeah, that's actually what you're talking about is what inspired that part of the book. Same kind of, I did the same kind of inner work, and also just find reparenting and inner child work to be not just healing, but mind blowing. And when I was doing that kind of work, I just felt it had so much potential creatively to kind of blow out. It just blew my story out of the water. Like it sounds like a pun on the submarine, but it, you know, when I was doing that kind of therapy work while I was writing the book, and when I started to combine them and explore them together, everything just started really humming. And so, yeah, that's exactly what it's about. That is it. It's like, is she gonna, and also these are just three parts. There can be a lot more than three, but, they kind of have to work together. They're not working together. So like Smushbug is the keeper of all the shame and like the sort of abuse that happened to them to Catherine when she was little. And Truitt, who's the boy, doesn't want to hear about it. He doesn't want to admit it. He doesn't want to talk about it. He just wants to fix the submarine. He's a fixer. He just wants everybody to act right, get things working, shut up, stop talking, you know, stop talking about that. It never happened. And Smushbug is always wanting to talk, but is not allowed to talk. And she's not big enough to force her voice on everyone else. And then Star is like dissociated. She's not really even in a body. So she doesn't have a lot of agency or ability to do anything, but she's kind of the energy of the, like Catherine's energy. She's seductive. She's beautiful. She's funny. She's always in a good mood, but she's not in a body. So that's easy. So all of these parts are like directing Catherine. She doesn't know it. She does not know it. She doesn't want to know it because she doesn't want to know what they have to tell her. So the question is she going to listen or not? Like, and that's sort of what keeps the book like sort of the plot going forward.
Yeah. I mean, in a way it sounds like this is the only time this book could have come out of you, is after having done this kind of work.
Well, yeah. And like I said, I think those parts were all there that first time I was trying to write that novel, but I was smoking pot all the time. You know, when I was in college, like I would get notes on my papers, like, it seems like you were really high when you wrote this. And then I would be so offended. But of course I was, you know, I would go away to see the TA and be like, I'm really offended that you would say that, you know, but of course I was. So I could not think straight. I couldn't sort it all out, but they were all there then too. I didn't have enough sort of maturity and mental health or the therapy tools to sort it out. So yeah, I don't think, yeah, I could never have written this novel before I started doing that kind of inner child work.
So back in those days, when you were smoking pot all the time, did anybody sit you down and try and make you watch Reefer Madness?
No. I didn't know where you're going with that. I know. I don't think I ever did see that movie.
Oh, that one was
a lot of Pink Floyd. A lot of Pink Floyd.
Nothing wrong with a lot of Pink Floyd.
My dentist yesterday, my Friday, my dentist was playing Pink Floyd. I just thought that was hilarious. He said, people really seem to enjoy this. I was like, yeah, it kind of goes with the dental experience.
Yeah. I often get, the laughing gas, as they call it, whenever I have like major dental work done, and I always have like Pink Floyd on my playlist just to get me through it. It's something about David Gilmour's guitar sound that is just so damn soothing. Contrasted to Roger Gilmour's lyrics and his vocal styles, which is not always soothing, but somehow it works. Somehow it works.
Well, my dentist definitely has a deep understanding of who the clientele are. So
I have to ask, this picture over your shoulder there, is that one of yours? Did you do that?
That is something. Yeah, I did paint that. It's a neuron. That's part of my new novel. That's what, because so like, let's say the submarine is the designing principle of the novel, in the sense that the metaphor of the submarine rising through the water and then it hits the surface and then what it gets, you know, I don't want to go into all the details. You can imagine what, you know, the whole thing about a submarine. I think part of the reason Catherine doesn't want the submarine to rise up is because then it's exposed and then it's in danger of being bombed or whatever could happen. And although it's also a weapon, you know, so I really use that submarine as a designing principle to structure the novel. So I'm trying to use the human body, as a designing principle for my new novel, which is called The Emotional Future. So I've done a lot of research into neurons, and I think what I'm going to, and I'm, it's still kind of evolving, but I think I'm, and it's funny because it's, I'm sure you'll be familiar with this if you've done a lot of inner work, but I think what I'm going to use as my designing principle is fight or flight, the fight or flight instinct to sort of, create the plot structure for the novel. See if that works. It may not work, but it's kind of crazy. But I like to play games like that, process games. So. Yeah.
Whenever I hear the term fight or flight, you know, the clash, should I stay or should I go, starts playing in my head. Whenever I hear the fight or flight response, the old parasite.
That's pretty funny.
System.
Well, I feel like the Clash were a very spiritually evolved band. I think they were kind of masquerading as. That they didn't give a hell, they didn't give a F, you know, didn't, I don't want to say a bad word, but you know, they were, but I think they were really deep and really spiritual. So I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if they weren't tapping into some of that.
Well, I mean, certainly when you think of the punk scene of that time, it would have been antithetical to the punk scene to have any kind of, you know, depth to your music. I mean, a lot of it was not, very deep, but you know, I agree. The Clash, and then what came after them? Big Audio Dynamite, I think, formed from the Clash, and you know, a lot more poppy, but still produce some toe tappers. But you know, it's funny. I've been looking at that painting over your shoulder. I'm like, that is a neuron, and those are dendrites.
Oh, you knew it. Okay, good.
Cell membrane. I'm like, that has to be. I mean, because it could be a weird tree, but to me, it was like, it was definitely, and this is the psych nerd in me. Like, I'm like, I think that's those are dendrites. I'm pretty sure that's what those things are.
Well, I'm also a psych nerd. So I'm a psych nerd. And I also have found that doing visual art while I'm writing really keeps me grounded. And that, you know, you were asking me like, what happened? Why did suddenly you turn a corner and you could write a novel that people wanted to read and that could get published? And part of that too was just, I just learned to ground myself in creative processes that keep me like sort of physically attached to what I'm writing about. So I cut things up, I glue them down on paper. Like I have this thing I'm working with. It's like all these different colors on paper. I use lots of, I love my school supplies. I use different colored pens. I make collages, I make paintings. And that before it was sort of, my writing was over here and my art was over here, but now they're, like I have this, nobody can see this, but I have this weird thing that I cut out. And I just, maybe it's procrastination, but somehow I really am praying that I'll come up with another novel with all this creative behavior, which isn't always writing. And that doesn't work for me, just to sit in front of a computer and be like, what happens next? What happens next? What happens next? What happens next? That I can't succeed doing that.
Yeah.
As a writer.
But it sounds like you're integrating, we were talking about parts of self, you're integrating all these creative parts of yourself and channeling it maybe into using a few different mediums, but eventually winding up on paper. And that's
hopefully,
that's a superpower that I'd say many authors do not possess.
Well, everybody's different. Every book is different. Every writer is different. And I feel like I've gotten permission because I sold this book to be myself and try it again. And just, I kind of have to have faith. It's like, I'm just like, I'm doing this. And if it doesn't work, I'll try something different. But the fight or flight thing, that just came to me last week. And cause I kept looking at, I have like things that I'm interested in, like the adrenal glands and the neurons and the tears and eyes and fear and feelings. And they all kind of come together in fear and fight or flight. And then I started learning all kinds of weird stuff about different trauma responses. I think fight or flight is just the one that we're most familiar with, but there are a lot of them.
Yeah.
So, and it's dissociation is one of them. And so what I wanted to say was that part of the reason it helps me so much to use all of the visual, the crayons and the writing and the drawing and the cutting is because I can get pretty dissociated a little bit just in my head and I just kind of drift off and I'm not really... Yeah, it's just easy for me to lose my focus. So it keeps me focused.
Yeah. And focus is important when you're banging out, you know, 100,000 or so words.
I wish. I wish I were banging out that many words.
Well, I always overestimate, you know, they always wind up to be 75,000 or so. But, you know, for me, I've got to give in 100 in order to get back 75 that are worth anything, maybe.
That makes sense. And again, like, you know, I'm always amazed. Do you like Stephen King?
Oh, yeah.
I'm just like amazed by his output, you know, and he's just got a different brain than mine. And if my brain worked that way, I would love to be pounding out, you know, really long thrillers. I would love it. I just don't, my brain doesn't work that way.
No, I'm convinced he's got more than one brain. It's just not possible to turn out that much. And it's so varied too. I mean, there are many different sides of his writing. I mean, each of his books have, you know, multiple facets to them. You know, even, you know, the scary ones are about something more than monsters. But, you know, even, you know, he's got books other than, you know, thrillers and stuff, which I always loved. I loved like 11/22/63 about the Kennedy assassination was, you know, not a scary book at all, but it was fascinating and long, but it was great.
I haven't read that. I mean, I've read sort of his classics. Yeah. And. But I think he was driven by demons. And I was thinking, I had like sort of a tough weekend, or like, a, you know, the last few days, I was just not feeling great. I had stuff I was feeling terrible about. And I've just, sometimes the way that I make peace with it is just, well, I'm just going to channel that into some writing. You know, that's always been the way for me. I've just survived that way. You know, if something's really bothering me, like when I was younger, I would write a poem about it. Like in high school, if I was sad, I would write a poem. And then in my 20s, I was a singer-songwriter, and that saved my life. Just, you know, pounding away on an acoustic guitar and write. And, you know, with a song, you can just, it's a puzzle, right? So you can spend five, six months working on one song. It's really therapeutic. So sometimes with Stephen King, I just think, boy, he's got shit to work out. And thank God he wrote, because if he hadn't been a writer, he might have been like a serial killer or something. No, you know?
He'd be one of his own villains, probably.
Kinda, right? I mean, it seems very driven. I think probably, I know you have a lot of writers that listen to this. Like, I think that it's a good way to just channel that frenzied or questing or dissatisfied energy. It always works for me. Drink a cup of coffee and just start writing.
Yeah. Well, one way I like,
it doesn't always work for me. That was a lie. When it works for me, I'm happy. A lot of times it doesn't work.
But it's the approach you take.
Well, it's just one of the, you know, I felt like one of the things you were asking about earlier was how do you keep going? Why do you keep going? I mean, I think sometimes for me, it's just internal pain. I just keep going because it soothes me.
Well, it's probably better than smoking a whole bunch of pot.
I hope so. I haven't done that in a long time, but to each their own.
That's true. It's a judgment.
I don't want to judge anybody. Who knows who's listening and what they might have just taken a big gummy bear and sat down to enjoy their favorite podcast. So if that's the case, that's okay too.
Well, if they just took it, it might only hit in an hour. So, you know, timing is everything in life. That's what I say. I always like to end with a couple of pop culture-y type questions to get to know my guests.
Oh, no.
I know. Okay. These are always scary. But I'm curious, when you were younger, when you were a kid, did you have any favorite TV shows?
Of course. It just depends on what age. Well, yeah, I mean, if I tell you my favorite TV shows, it's going to really date me. Everyone's going to know exactly what year I was born. But I was the kid that came home after school and watched TV, you know, straight from like 3:30 to 7:30 when my parents got home from work and maybe turned off the TV. So it was just like a complete Gilligan's Island, Hogan's Heroes, The Partridge Family, The Brady Bunch. You know, there's like seven shows that kind of line Mary Tyler Moore Show, 70 shows. So I think by the time I got old enough to, I wasn't like such a latchkey kid. I didn't watch as much TV, but yeah, that's who I grew up with.
What was the last time you really sat down and gave a good hard think about Gilligan's Island?
I think about it quite often, actually. I mean, I'm constantly like going back to Google all of the characters were so alive in my imagination. I thought they were all real in some way. So Well, they I didn't quite get that they were actors and actresses.
You're like thinking that that could be like the first, you know, reality TV.
Well, like Ginger. Yeah, Ginger. I mean, yeah, I was pretty young when I was watching that. I just figured that's how she went around the world in her real life in like a little cocktail dress. And maybe she did. I can't say she didn't. I actually met Bob Denver at a parade.
Did you really?
Yeah.
My
disappointing.
Well, my father grew up with Bob Denver. He was from New Rochelle.
Oh, really?
From New Rochelle, New York. Yeah. And yeah, he grew up with him and he said he was a weird kid, Michael. He was a weird kid. Like, yeah. So I'm like, Dad, how many interactions did you actually have with Gilligan? You know, or is this like the rumor mill through like the town of New Rochelle, New York? But
yeah. So is he like, is he sort of New Rochelle's most famous son? They probably have quite a few.
You know, I think the Dillon boys, you know, Matt Dillon and his siblings, I think were from.
Oh, are they from New Rochelle?
They're from like New Rochelle.
I picked them for Long Island boys.
No, oh. they were New Rochelle kids. I had friends who grew up with them too. But
wow.
Yeah, those some of New Rochelle's fans. He was, Matt Dillon was spotted. He skipped school one day. And he went to the beach and some agent or talent scout, you know, spotted him at the beach, saw he had a look. And next thing you know, he's in the pictures, as they say.
I was always dreaming that that would happen to me.
Yeah. Yeah. No such luck here. Yeah. But maybe it's because I didn't skip school. Maybe that was the secret. If I had just skipped school one or two times.
Yes, that's the message. That's the message that you need to send out to the nation's youth.
That's right. So my three college age kids right now skip school every now and then, and you know, make sure I don't get my money's worth. What about music? What were you into musically when you were younger?
I wasn't very cool about music in my teens. I just listened to Top 40. And then in college, I got more interesting, mostly because of the people I was hanging out with. But I would say, you know, in high school, I listened to Madonna, Cyndi Lauper, Pink Floyd. I thought Pink Floyd was very edgy. I don't really have anything exciting to report musically.
What about college? How did you get more interesting in college with regards to music?
Just with people I was hanging out with. And also I started playing an instrument. I was sort of the girl who went to see all the boys' bands play in their bands and had crushes on all the boys that were in bands in college, and then realized, well, wait a minute, why don't you just play an instrument? Like, you don't have to be the groupie in the front row. You can actually play an instrument. And so I learned to play the guitar. And I just, you know, one of my best friends was from New Rochelle, actually. We'll have to talk about that after the episode. But he was just into, we would go down to CBGBs and we would see bands like Urge Overkill and, you know, edgy Live Skull, like edgy sort of hardcore rock bands. It wasn't what I was playing. I was playing acoustic music, but it definitely introduced me to the whole, just, we would just go to record stores and stand there for hours flipping through albums. It was really more his hobby than mine, but I just got exposed to the New York City music scene. And I can't ever go back and change the fact that I listened to Top 40 until I was 19 years old, but things changed, luckily for me, because I actually played music in my 20s. I was a musician.
Yeah.
So.
And then kind of last up, this is always one of the more challenging.
These are hard questions. You didn't give me the heads up on these. You told me the first, not the last. Is this the last one? Because this is going to be the ultimate stumper.
I know. I don't think it'll be a stumper given all the self-work you've done. But if you could go back in time and whisper some words of advice into the younger Boo's ear, what would you tell your younger self?
I would tell her to always be on her own side. No matter what, even if she's wrong, just be on your own side, stick up for yourself and put yourself first. I know it sounds selfish, but nobody else is gonna.
You see, that wasn't a hard question.
I might regret it later. I'm really going to regret the Gilligan's Island, but I can't go back in time.
Hey, here's my thing for Gilligan's Island. The professor could build a radio out of coconuts and like some, he could build an exercise bike out of all of the various, you know, an exercise bike that could power the radio. Why not fix the hole in the boat? You know, why not fix the boat and get them off the island? This has plagued me for, I guess since childhood.
That's a really good question. Did he even try? Weren't they always trying to fix the boat and get off island? I feel like that was, there was always, maybe they were just trying to flag. They were always just trying to flag down planes.
Yeah.
I don't think they were really trying to get off the island. They were just enjoying their coconut cocktails. And
it seems like they were having a grand time. No one had to pay taxes, I imagine, over that time. They seem to be eating.
Oh, Little well. House on the Prairie. I forgot to mention Little House on the Prairie. Yeah.
Well, I mean, Pa playing the fiddle is very disappointed. The ghost of Michael Landon is going to come haunt you tonight for forgetting that. Well, I have to ask, where can people learn more about you, Boo? If people want to learn more either about your writing, your music, your art, where could they go?
Well, I'm glad you asked. Well, first of all, back to the novel, The Daughtership. Barnes & Noble has been very kind, and I've heard a lot of people have said it's out on their display, like right out on the front table with the fiction. So if you'd like to go to brick and mortar, I think that's a good place to go. And there's Amazon and Bookshop, which is an indie bookseller online, is always good to support the indies. So yeah, it's everywhere. So you can buy the book. And then if you just want to check my shenanigans out, that's on Instagram. Most of them's on Instagram. I am sort of slightly embarrassing myself on TikTok, but very, very minimally. But yes, I'm on Instagram as Boo Trundle.
All right. I'll be sure to put links to your book as well as your website and your social media in our show notes so people can just tap on those to learn and follow. Boo, I have to say, thank you so much for stopping by Uncorking a Story and letting me uncork yours.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for uncorking me.
Thanks for listening to Uncorking a Story. If you'd like more information about today's guest or to find out more about Mike, go to uncorkingastory.com. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Tune in every week to hear Mike Carlin uncork a new story.